Welcome to the Infrastructure Show. I'm your host, Professor Joseph Schoffer, and I'm the director of Northwestern University's Infrastructure Technology Institute.
And I'm your co-host, Tom Herman of Vocalo.org, 89.5 FM.
The Infrastructure Show is designed to present to listeners the reality of America's infrastructure, its condition, why it is the way it is, and what can be done about it.
Our topic for today is America's power infrastructure, the power plants and transmission lines that make up the electric grid. 70 years ago, in 1940, only 10% of energy consumption in this country was used to produce electricity. Growing population and rapidly changing technologies have pushed this percentage to 40%, and the percentage is rising.
While the country has been steadily adding electrical generation capacity, a key problem is that the transmission network in many areas of the country is outdated, and it can't handle the peak demand for electricity. Talking with us about this very important topic of power grid modernization is Mark McGranigan, who is Director of Distribution Research for the Electric Power Research Institute, or EPRI, which is an independent, nonprofit organization performing research and development for the electric power industry. Mark, thanks very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Can you tell us something about the overall condition of the electrical distribution network in the United States?
Well, you know, it varies in degree, you know, across the country and in individual areas. We have investments in the transmission and distribution network that are 50 to 100 years old, and we have investments that, you know, are being put in continuously, the capital budget of electric utilities to invest in the grid is very large every year, so it's continually being expanded and upgraded, but it does include equipment, that's quite old, and it's designed to last a long time, so that's not necessarily the end of the world in and of itself. There are issues in terms of the infrastructure's ability to handle getting power from the locations where we would like to be generating it today to where the load centers are. That's a continual challenge. And there's also challenges associated with the more local distribution systems in being able to handle the kinds of loads and distributed generation that we would like to connect to those systems. So there are particular issues, but overall it's a very large investment that we have in the electrical grid, and it's continually being upgraded. It's one of the it's probably the largest investment in a machine that we have in the world.
Who's responsible for it? Who owns it? Who maintains it? Who's got to pay for its upkeep?
Well, that varies as well. Especially in this country, we have for the distribution grid, we have about 3,500 companies that own and maintain the distribution system. We have a smaller number of companies that own, maintain, and operate the transmission system. That's a little bit more complicated. In most parts of the country, we have system operators that are responsible for operating the transmission grid and controlling where the power goes, and those may or may not be the same company that actually own the transmission lines. So, and that's a much smaller number of companies.
If there's over 3,000 companies with this distribution change, do they need to interact very intensely with each other?
Well, the distribution companies don't need to interact with each other so much. They're interconnected through the transmission system. So, you know, we have a transmission grid that's very interconnected. We have basically three transmission grids in this country. We have an Eastern United States grid. We have a Western United States grid, and Texas has its own grid. They like it that way. And those are interconnected through some relatively weak interconnections that are through what we call HVDC interconnections, so they're not synchronously connected. If something happens in one of those grids, it won't affect the other two. And distribution systems, on the other hand, are much more local, and they're pretty much independent from each other. They connect through the transmission system, but we can operate and maintain and control a local distribution system and pretty much have everything under our control that we need to have.
So is there coordination among these the various owner operators of components of the grids to direct investment in some kind of strategic way, or are they all really acting independently?
there's a lot of coordinating organizations that and standards that help these companies make investments in technologies that should work together and be interoperable and have a lifetime where we'll continue to be able to add new technologies to interface with them. So the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers, IEEE, has a lot of standards activities and groups that virtually all these electric utilities belong to. There's many other organizations as well. The National Institute of Standards and Technology right now is coordinating a lot of the interoperability standards work to try to make sure this is even better coordinated in the future.
What I'm thinking about is beyond standards. Is there some strategic approach, national approach to investment or reinvestment in the grid, or is it really primarily market driven?
It's driven by the needs of each individual system and the age, and at the distribution level, the responsibility for approving investments in the grid lies at the state. Each state has regulators, electric industry regulators, that the owners and operators of the distribution grid, they develop their plans, and that happens in a very fairly consistent way across the country of planning what's needed for the grid in order to support the load and the kinds of equipment that are being connected to it. They submit those plans to their regulators, and those regulators are different in every state, and they have different priorities, and those regulators approve them, because virtually all these utilities work on a basis of cost recovery and getting a rate of return on their investments in that grid. They're not competing with each other. They're just operating in a fairly regulated manner.
How vulnerable is the grid to storms, accidents, to falling apart, you know, with age over time?
There's lots of things that can cause problems with the grid. You mentioned a number of them: ice, hurricanes, storms and wind and trees in general all can cause problems. And the more widespread those storms are, or those systems are, the more widespread the disturbance can be. But the grid is designed to be able to respond to disturbances like that and basically repair itself or send power down a different path for most conditions. And then for those that actually take the system down, utilities have systems in place to respond to outages and storms and stuff that gets the system back up and running, you know, as fast as possible. So for the most part, it's vulnerable, but we have one of the most reliable systems in the world, and we're continually trying to improve that. But that's a cost benefit type of analysis that we're always doing in terms of how much more we invest to make it less vulnerable versus the economic benefit of a few less minutes of outages in a year.
When you say one of the best in the world or the best in the world, are we on a par with other nations, you know, that are highly developed like us, or is our system even better than other European countries and places that we think of as being highly advanced?
We're right on a par with European grids in terms of reliability statistics. There's a few places like Singapore and Japan and Korea that have decided to put a larger investment into the grid and have better reliability statistics than we do. And they advertise that and try to attract those industries that are very sensitive to, you know, even a momentary interruption in a year and try to get them to locate there. On the other hand, we can match that level of reliability for specific areas in the grid, and we do that when we need to supply power to critical facility, data centers, semiconductor manufacturing facilities, that kind of thing.
How are those countries that do somewhat better able to do it? Is it because they have a stronger central government that's doing the kind of long-term thinking or planning?
That has something to do with it, and the government is willing to put the money in. They tend to be government-sponsored electric utilities, and they consider that investment as part of their economic development for the whole country. So they put more money into the grid, and that translates sometimes if they want to get it paid for through the electric rates for their consumers. You know, they may have significantly higher electric rates than we do in order to pay for that infrastructure. So it has to be paid for some way, but if it's considered part of the economic development for the whole country, it sometimes can be justified that way.
Mark, can you tell us a little bit more about the interconnects between regional and cross-border elements of the distribution system, and particularly curious about the extent to which they are able to isolate failures in the system?
Yeah. Now, the word distribution is usually used to refer to the portion of the grid that is the last bit of the grid that gets from a substation down to individual houses, and that's not really very interconnected. But the transmission grid is probably what we're talking about here in terms of interconnections. And you know, I mentioned that there's three basic transmission grids in the country, and for instance, the Eastern transmission grid is all very interconnected, so that has the advantage of being able to transmit power from the most efficient generators wherever they are to wherever the load is in the grid. And then it has sometimes the disadvantage that a disturbance in Ohio can make the grid unstable in New York. So you kind of have to take the advantages and disadvantages of interconnecting such a wide area of the system. And that's part of our objectives in the smart grid, is be able to have earlier warning when disturbances are having widespread impacts, and be able to respond to that, to those kinds of situations, in an intelligent manner to limit the extent of the disturbance to a small part of the grid, even though it's interconnected.
Can you give us a little bit more information about what the smart grid is and what can we expect from it?
Well, usually the term smart grid, and there's different definitions for every person that you'd be talking to, but usually we mean overlaying a communication and information infrastructure that's more extensive than it is already today. There already is large communication infrastructure that's part of operating the power grid. But in the smart grid, we talk about a communication infrastructure that basically extends all the way to every consumer and has the ability to integrate consumers and distributed resources throughout the system with the overall operation of the grid. So instead of having just a system that takes power from large generating stations, steps it up in voltage to a high voltage on a transmission system, and sends that power to some location closer to where the load is, steps it down to a distribution voltage, and gets it to final distance to the customer, and the customer uses it. Instead of that, we have now customers that are able to control their load in response to the conditions on the grid. They may have storage. The storage may be electric vehicles. It may be batteries or some other type of storage. And we have distributed generation like photovoltaics and wind that are distributed around the system, and they all can be managed together. And the communication and information infrastructure to do that is the thing that we don't have right now, that extends all the way to every customer.
When you say that the customer or the end user can kind of tailor their use depending on what's going on in the grid, is the idea that they can draw power at a time when it would be cheapest for them to do so, and then have some means for storing it and be more efficient in that way?
That's a good way to describe it, and it's one of the ways that it's being talked about that this could be implemented of using price as the primary method of communicating when is the best time to use power and when would be a good time to not use as much power. Price is one way to do that. Direct control is another way, and that's being used in some of the experiments as well, where customers give the utility the rights and the ability to directly control some of their load, whether it's water heaters or thermostats on their air conditioning, and they might change the status of those loads on a rolling basis to benefit the grid. They would get something in return for that, either just payments or rate reduction or something. But so whether it's like a real-time price where the customer always has the ability to respond to the price of power that is indicative of how expensive it is to produce at that time, or if it's some way of giving the utility control of loads and storage and maybe the photovoltaics on their roof to match the needs of the system at any given time. That there's a lot of different ways it can be done once the communication infrastructure is there.
So this is a particularly interesting strategy because it sounds like information flows in both directions, from producer to consumer and consumer to producer, and use price as a signal to gain kind of overall control of the equilibrium between demand and supply. Is that a fair way to characterize this?
Yeah, it's a very good way. And the big push that we have now in terms of looking at electric vehicles, you mentioned that a higher and higher percentage of our energy use is being supplied through electricity. And of course, if we move in the direction of taking a lot of our electric transportation energy use and putting that in the electric domain, that'll, you know, move us even further in that direction. And that's a load that has the potential of being a very controllable load. So we can really benefit the grid if we do it right in terms of managing when we recharge batteries for a car. And price might be one way we're talking about. It would be a very attractive way to do that, of just being, have the car itself and the charger in the car be able to respond to price information and charge at the most opportune time. That way customers, if they had to charge when the electricity is expensive, they could do it. If they have flexibility, they could, you know, the car could just wait until the electricity is the cheapest and charge the battery then.
But it sounds to me, if we're able to do that, that we'll be able to meet more of the demands for electric power without adding generating capacity by smoothing out the demands.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the other piece of that is a lot of the generating capacity that we're talking about adding, wind and photovoltaic in particular, is variable and somewhat intermittent. So being able to control things on the demand side allows us to integrate more of that kind of generation than we would be able to if we had to match it up with conventional generators like gas turbines.
How hard is it to store energy? Because when you were giving the car example, I suddenly had the image of every house having an enormous battery that just fills up when electricity is cheap, and then the house runs off that giant battery.
Yeah. Well, it's very easy to store, and that's a great concept, except for energy storage is just very expensive right now. And, you know, in the foreseeable future, it's going to continue to be expensive. So it's a great concept, but it's not economical, you know, at all right now.
And just speaking as someone who doesn't know much about electricity, batteries at the store aren't that expensive. Why is storage expensive?
Well, yeah, batteries at the store actually are expensive when you talk about them in terms of kilowatt hours of storage capacity. And when you talk about them in terms of the very small storage capacity needed for a cell phone or a flashlight or whatever, that's, you know, they're not that expensive. But when you scale up to enough storage to be able to, you know, supply your air conditioning load in your house even for a half hour, you start to be talking about pretty big batteries.
So are you seeing, or do you foresee, more distributed power generation systems, such as wind farms and solar energy systems, and perhaps even the batteries from electric vehicles coming online in the next decade or so?
No question that the penetration of wind generation is going to continue to grow tremendously. Wind generation is already very economic compared to virtually any other type of generation, assuming that we can get the power to where we need to get it and that we can live with the variability of it. The cost of building the wind turbines and maintaining those units is turns out to be very attractive over the lifetime. So wind is right there. It's going to continue to expand worldwide. China's going crazy with wind generation as well. We will as well in this country. Mostly wind capacity is connected in large wind farms to the transmission grid. So in terms of getting the power to where we need it, it becomes a transmission problem. Photovoltaics, on the other hand, which is also expanding dramatically and increasing in penetration, is a type of generation that is very distributed and would be connected on local distribution systems in individual people's houses, on commercial buildings, and sometimes in solar farms like the one that you see in Florida that President Obama visited when he announced the stimulus awards. So we have a variety of different kinds of solar generation, but for the most part, it's very distributed, and the impacts are at the local distribution level where we have to deal with that variable nature of the solar generation.
And as you look over the entire system, distribution and transmission, what components of it are most in need of improvement?
That's a good question. The grid itself is in pretty good shape. So, you know, when we look at these investments, it's really, there's technologies to go on that transmission grid in terms of smart devices and switches and voltage control technologies. But the big investment is about the communication infrastructure. And there's a lot of questions about that right now. FCC is thinking about whether the electric utility should have spectrum, you know, in a wireless area that they can use for controlling the grid. Right now, utilities are putting in communication infrastructures that are basically proprietary protocols, and they're investing in communication infrastructures right in parallel with public infrastructures. And there's questions about whether that's wise. So there's a lot of questions about the communication infrastructure investment, but it's a big one. And it's probably, if you had to pick one need, that's the biggest enabler to making this smart grid happen, that communication infrastructure, and then the interface to the consumer, which people talk about as advanced metering is deploying at a very fast rate. But it's more than just an advanced meter. It's going to be, you know, an energy management interface at the home that talks to smart appliances and your smart thermostat and your electric vehicle charger. So the grid itself is, you know, it's really not in bad shape. We do need, one of the big needs that we have is just more transmission, not an investment in the existing transmission infrastructure. As if we're going to have big wind farms throughout the Midwest, then we want to be able to use that power in the Northeast and the East. The transmission grid can't do it. You know, it's not even close. So we need a lot more transmission lines just to be able to get the power from where some of these renewables, where the renewable capacity exists and is, you know, available to build wind farms, to where the load is. And that's a tremendous need.
So as we improve the availability of electric power, and at the same time it seems we're increasing our dependence on electric power, what I hear you saying is that it's not simply a matter of adding generating capacity in these various distributed forms, but it's really important that we pay attention to integrating this system and having effective and efficient ways to get the power directly to the consumer. And at the same time, I think it's an important takeaway for us is that you're telling us that it's likely in the future that consumers are going to be better able and better informed to manage their use of electricity.
That's exactly right. And hopefully they won't have to go around turning things on and off themselves. They'll have a, you know, controller in the house that can manage that for them and talk to their smart appliances and smart devices.
Well, let's hope the smart TV doesn't decide to shut off with 2 minutes left in the fourth quarter. And one final question. You mentioned there is an eastern and a western section to the power system, and then one for Texas, just Texas. Did Texas say we just don't want to be dependent on anybody else?
That's a polite way to say it. They made that decision a long time ago. They like to be their own grid.
Well, thank you so much, Professor. Anything?
Yes, Mark, thanks very much for bringing us up to speed. to date on what's going on with the electric power distribution system in the United States? It sounds like we've got good things to look forward to and some important investments and advances to make in the meantime. So thanks for being with us today.
Great talking to you guys.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.